Well, I want to thank the organizers of the meeting to invite me to give this presentation on what was for years referred to as epizootic bovine abortion by the research folks at the veterinary school here in Davis, but is more commonly referred to as foothill abortion. So if you're a cow-calf producer in California or Southern Oregon or Nevada, yeah, you know what this disease is about and you know how costly it is. And if you haven't heard about it and you're planning on sending some pregnant heifers to California, you'll wish you had heard about it before you sent them, because it's absolutely a devastating disease if you get into this. So the first slide here, you've got a lot of people, a lot of organizations. That's what I'm going to present today. It's truly been a collaborative effort. I've spent the last 30 years of my career here at the veterinary school working on foothill abortion and trying to solve some of the problems associated with it. But it has been a collaborative effort with the University of Nevada at Reno, the veterinary school, animal science here on campus, the California Cattlemen's Association. So the collaboration goes on and on. So what I'm going to try to do today is kind of give this a little bit of background to the disease for those of you not familiar with it, and then we'll a little bit about what we've done diagnostically recently, our current approach to developing a vaccine, and I would say instead of we're really not developing it now, we're testing it. And then we'll end up with some work that Brian Welly just completed with a master's in animal science in Dr. Van Enden's lab, and taking a genomics approach to this. So that's kind of where we'll go with this. Okay, so to start out with, we recognized this disease in California in the late 40s, early 50s. It wasn't until 2005 that we actually figured out what it was, because you can't identify what you can't grow. We still cannot propagate this microbe in any sort of synthetic media and cell cultures. And so it's been incredibly difficult to work with. But we have tentatively called it Pajuelabacter abortabovis. The Pajuela comes from the common name of the tick that transmits this disease. We kind of moved to talk this around about, well, that's going to be pretty hard for veterinary students to remember that name. And one of our older faculty said, well, he said, it took us this long to figure out what it was. It deserves a difficult name to pronounce. So I think we're going to stick with that. It's a mix of bacteria. There are no myxobacteria have ever been identified as a pathogen. The proteobacteria group that they're in is a huge group of bacteria. They have the largest genomes of any bacteria ever studied. So highly, highly unusual. Most of these myxobacteria are what they call fruiting, gliding bacteria in soil. So this is a little bit of an opportunistic bacteria that somehow has made it into the salivary gland of this very unusual tick and is able to develop in one single host, okay? Well, not necessarily a single host, but it can only survive, if you will, in an animal without an immune system, and that would be a developing bovine fetus. The other point I'll make of this bacteria is it probably only replicates, the best we can figure, about once a day. So if you're a bacteriologist, that's slower than slow. Okay, so just a little background here on foothill abortion. It's a term abortion, and that's one of the things that makes it so expensive. They get infected early on in gestation, and I just mentioned how slow this thing replicates. It replicates very slowly. It's an intracellular pathogen, so it gets into the macrophages in the animal, gets distributed throughout the body, and then as you approach term, the immune system develops. The immune system attacks all of these infected cells and basically causes its own demise. At that point, it becomes, if you will, in getting rid of the bacteria, it just creates such an inflammatory response that it induces an abortion. Up to 90% fetal mortality. When we see the really big wrecks with foothill abortion, it's those folks that have never heard of foothill abortion, and they bring pregnant animals into an area that has the tick, and then as you get out and you start approaching your calving window, they just come in waves. So animals that are incredibly naive get into an area that has a lot of this tick. You can approach 100% loss, and we've seen wrecks like this all the way out into north central Nevada, where animals have been brought in, groups of heifers of 700, 800, and basically a total loss. The window of susceptibility, I have 60 days here with a question mark to 140 days gestation. We now know that we're going to slide this way back, okay? We just finished some studies now, and this bug can cause you grief even before you, if they've been actually infected before they breed, if it's close to breeding. But this is your classical window. Once you get past 140 days gestation, even if the fetus gets infected, by the time that the fetus is already starting to develop an immune system at this point in time, and it will eliminate that pathogen with very little effect. So if you can keep your animals away from the ticks until they're out about 160 days gestation, you're usually fine. Distribution, California, if we looked at the study in the early 2000s, it was estimated in the state of California it was a $3 million loss, but the disease probably underdiagnosed, and obviously animals are worth a little bit more than they were in the early 2000s today. So it's a huge loss. We have no idea relative to the dollar losses in Nevada and Oregon. Diagnosis, pathology does not develop until approximately 100 days post-infection. That's why it was so difficult to work with. But it's probably one of the few fetal diseases reproductive diseases that you can pretty much diagnose foothill abortion just by the unique pathology. And so that's why, in fact, it was diagnosed in the absence of knowing what the etiologic agent was. This is the tick. It's called the Pajuela tick. Ornithodorus coriaceus. Its distribution is in Mexico, California, Nevada, and Oregon. And how did they determine this tick was a vector? Well, it was an observation by one of the extension entomologists that this distribution pretty much overlaid the distribution of foothill abortion. So some experiments were done and demonstrated it. Their rapid feeders are not your standard tick, okay? They come up out of the duff, they live in the duff, they come up out of the duff when an animal beds down, they jump on, they grab a blood meal in about 15 to 20 minutes, and they come back off. Probably why you don't have them out in Colorado, Utah, and farther places east is these ticks are not the type of tick that gets onto an animal, stays on, embeds, and can be transported by truck. They're long-lived. These ticks can live up to 10 years. You can't burn them out. We found that out. You look at areas where range fires have gone through. They live deep enough in the duff. Those range fires go across the top. And the only thing that the producers say is after a range fire and they come back on 3 years, those ticks are flat-out hungry. And they probably have the worst losses they ever have when you come back onto some of these ranges. Number one, you may have lost some of your immunity. If you move your animals into an area that didn't have so many ticks, you come back home. And these guys have been waiting for a blood meal to come along. The greatest tick activity is made October. Fall calving can ease losses. Works pretty well. Didn't work this year. Didn't work last year. Okay, and why? Well, because couldn't get exposure to those replacements because there was no feed under those oak trees. So a lot of the replacement heifers went to feed yards this year, and they're all naive, and everybody knows what's coming, and there's just nothing you can do about it except try to keep them out of the foothills. And like I say, the reason it's called foothill abortion is you find the tick under trees. The ticks hate water. We don't find them in the Central Valley. Okay, we don't find them in the coastal areas. It's too damp. They absolutely hate the moisture. The higher the elevation, the colder it gets. You pretty much find these ticks on the south-facing slopes. You can pre-expose the replacement heifers. That's a concept that's used a lot. For some people, it just doesn't seem to work. You just can't seem to get these animals immune. And, of course, then you go through, especially if you're spring calver, you're just not going to get that exposure. By the time those animals are weaned off, they're coming home. Most of those ticks are fed up, probably, and so you're just not getting exposure there. Avoid the tick fields during susceptibility. That's about the easiest way to manage this disease, but that's not so easy to realize. Feeding ticks up prior to arrival of heifers. Some people have used that approach. Run stalkers out into these areas that have the tick before they move the heifers in, the naive heifers in. Like I say, this is largely a disease of that we associate with naive heifers because as opposed to the aged animals that are continually exposed to these ticks. Okay, diagnosis. It's diagnosed largely by gross pathology and microscopic pathology. There's pathognomonic lesions in the thymus. We've developed serologic tests. They have the fetuses have elevated serum immunoglobulins, in fact, screaming levels of Ig, which they shouldn't, right? If they're aborted and have not acquired colostrum. And there's a polymerase chain reaction developed for this now as well. Okay, just very quickly, I don't want to dwell on this. This is a classic term abortion, kind of a pot belly. You can see they're haired up. The teeth are erupted. They've got the big pot belly here because of all the acidic fluid that accumulates in the peritoneal cavity. A big mottled liver, a spleen that is absolutely gigantic, comes all the way down under the mid part of the belly. That should be nice and white. That's the cervical thymus there. It's completely hemorrhagic. It's very classic for Foothill abortion. Lymph nodes, especially the prescapular lymph node, you can usually just palpate that with your hand. Absolutely huge, about the size of a big Frankfurter. And then all of these petechial lesions that we see on the mucosal surfaces. So how did we move forward? Well, we finally found an animal model for studying this. We used immunodeficient mice that have no immune system, and we were finally able to get this bug to grow. And that's when we were finally able to work with this thing. So what do we get when we inoculate mice without an immune system? All you get is a wasting disease, resulting with a large spleen, and that spleen is loaded with macrophages that have the bacteria intracellularly, so we can harvest those cells out of there. And that's really what we've moved forward with, both diagnostically and as a vaccine. And it takes about the same time to make that mouse sick as it does a bovine fetus, okay? So, in fact, the only reason we ever figured out we could grow it in these mice is when we tried SCID mice. We kept them for a month and nothing happened, but we got busy. We forgot about them. And they stayed out there for 3 months running up per diem at the animal care facility. And then somebody called us one day and said, something wrong with those mice you've got out there. They've got some sort of a wasting disease. And so that's, in fact, how we were able to determine this. We passed it twice in mice, put it back into pregnant heifers in the sweet spot, about 100 days gestation, and caused Foothill abortion, recreated the disease in all of them. Okay, so diagnostics, just a quick slide. We've developed an immunofluorescence assay to detect antibodies to this bacteria. It's been validated, works excellent in bovine fetuses right now. We're validating it for use in adult cattle. The reason we're doing that is it'll allow us, first time ever, to do epidemiologic studies. Is antibody a marker of immunity? We believe it will be, and we think it will allow us to facilitate management of animal movement to decrease losses. So in other words, if you want to test a bunch of heifers, have they been exposed? Am I safe to move them into an area with that has this tick? Do they have antibody? Are they probably resistant or more than likely susceptible? So it'll probably expand the window of where we recognize Foothill abortion. So, vaccine. We decided it was a potential vaccine candidate. Again, we took necropsy tissues out of some select fetuses. We put it into these SCID mice. We developed an assay whereby we could enumerate the number of infected macrophages in the spleen. You just mush that spleen through a little sieve and get a single cell suspension so you can QC this. We cryopreserve these just like you would rate frozen, as you would semen or you would cell cultures that you want to freeze down. And then we thawed these back out and attempted to develop a vaccine. So really, we're calling it a vaccine, but really what it is, it's a controlled infection. Okay, so vaccine efficacy. These are just 4 years here of our early studies. This is the first study we did. All I want to bring your attention to here for the sake of moving through these slides at a decent pace is the red are the placebos, and the green are the animals that were vaccinated. These were all challenged, all hand challenged, with high doses of bacteria in the sweet spot. So what you have here is vaccine dose. We use varying doses. They were immunized, then they were bred, okay, and then out at 100 days pregnancy, then they were challenged with high levels of bacteria. And so these are the losses that we realized in the placebos over those 4 years. And over those 4 years, we never lost a single fetus to Foothill abortion that had been exposed to our what we're calling our vaccine. We approached the USDA about the potential of licensing this, and they were very positive. We worked with the Department of Agriculture, the Center for Veterinary Biologics at Ames. They've been integrally involved in all of the studies we've done. So when we get this thing out here to the point which we have, where it looks like a viable vaccine, a company's not going to have to go back and start all over with these studies. Actually, everything we've done has been recorded and will help facilitate the licensure of this vaccine. So safety was number one. We looked for adverse reactions. We collected data from over 2,000 head on 10 ranches in about the first 4 years. Immediate reactions, obviously we're looking for any anaphylactic shock. None were noted to date. Systemic delayed reactions, none were noted. Localized injection reactions, here's the days post-vaccination. They are very slow developing. There's a story behind this, and we think that's why this controlled infection is inducing such solid and long-term immunity that we're seeing, and that is it appears that when you infect the animal, like say the bacteria replicates slow. If you look at the mouse, the bacteria goes to the uterus, and it actually replicates in the epithelial cells lining the uterus in a mouse. So we're assuming the same thing probably happens to the heifer. It develops an immune response, and then out here, peaking around 30 days, after they've been vaccinated, you have all of these lymphocytes come back into the initial site of the reaction. There's no neutrophils, just probably memory lymphocytes coming back in and eliminating that bacteria that's still alive in those macrophages at the site of inoculation. So we think it's kind of like a booster type response. Well, I hit something here. There we go. We've seen no impact upon conception rate. They've been similar between vaccinants and controls. Embryonic losses, I'm going to come back to that. I'll tell you right now, if you get too tight to vaccination, it's going to cause embryonic losses. But it wasn't an easy question to answer. And we have a USDA-approved 90-day withholding period for the vaccine before they can enter the food chain. Okay, we went out into the field, what we're looking at is two ranches that we worked with that had severe foothill losses. Both of these were northeastern California, and what these ranches saw was a 25 to 60% loss every single year in their heifers, and it is just consistent as can be. So all I want to bring, the red is diagnosed foothill, and this color here is animals that just came open. They knew they were pregnant, right? When they came in and off the range, they were pregnant. But trust me, the coyotes and the eagles and whatnot in that country, you very seldom recover a fetus that you can get a diagnosis on. And that's why this is so small. But it's pretty easy to see, if you just want to look at healthy calves, it's pretty easy to see the difference between those that were vaccinated over here on the right and those that were not vaccinated. We split those herds the first 2 years to the chagrin of the producers. They said, let's just vaccinate them all. And we said, no, we can't. We want to make sure this vaccine doesn't have problems. We don't want anything to be blamed on this. So we split the herds half vaccinated, half placebo for the first 2 years, and then we moved to vaccinating all of them here in the last couple of years. So if you look at this first ranch here, you're just looking at a healthy calf crop. 97% healthy calf crop in the vaccinates, 53% in the controls, 41% tough year for them, 100% healthy calves in the controls. So in underfield conditions, the vaccine looks excellent. Duration of immunity, we've just started some studies here. This is a single study we did. The numbers are pretty low here, but this 17 months post-vaccination, these three animals were 28 months post-vaccination. The placebos we used in the trial. We see good solid immunity, even though it's a small number, on out here to 28 months. And we're figuring that probably the duration of immunity is going to be good here. And a little bit of tick exposure along the way, it may just be a one-shot deal for the life of that animal, unless they're moved out of the country for a long period of time. Potential for embryonic loss. All I really want to, what you're looking at here is these, the blues are just the non-breds, but what you're looking at here is what we, fetal losses. These are the 33 to 34, 35 to 36. These are the days between vaccination and breeding, okay? And then out here, we move to 80 days. And what we saw versus placebo versus the vaccinates, and these are in private producer herds, is we saw this little bit of a what we felt was an early fetal mortality. But if you did the stats on it, it just wasn't statistically significant. So the question was, we're just chasing shadows, or in fact, is this real? So we moved to the animal sciences herd up at Sierra Research Station, better controlled. We can get more pregnancy evaluations up there. And all I really want to bring your attention to here is the 33, 34 days. This is the interval between vaccination and breeding, and we had quite a loss of quite a few fetal mortalities, early fetal mortalities in the vaccinates. And the other thing I bring your attention to is this color here. Those are those that took by AI, okay? The front line here or the bull breads, what got cleaned up. So it appeared to be, the fetal mortality appeared to be associated with those animals that bred the quickest, and that would represent the shortest period between vaccination and conception. So we moved through, we finally put a large group of animals together last year, and we got a statistically significant. USDA wanted to know whether it was real or not. It had to be, it's going to have to be put on the label. And here we went 29 days intentionally with a window. We bred these up with bulls over a 21-day period, and we had a 7% fetal mortality on those. And you probably wouldn't see that if you were in the cow-calf operation out on the range. They'd breed back, okay? But this was pretty evident. If you break this down even further, 12% of the pregnant animals, okay, that bred early, and this is they're broken down here into those that bred right out of the gate with the bull and those that bred later over that 21-day period, 22% loss of the total number of pregnant animals. We had fetal mortalities. And if you broke this down even further, okay, and just looked at the pregnant animals that bred early right out of the gate, it was a 22% loss. So there's no question that has a huge implication for use of this vaccine. And right now we're suggesting use an interval of a minimum of 60 days and probably preferably 90 to make sure we don't get into that. It also has implications for range management. We're assuming that tick exposure will likely mimic the vaccine exposure. Okay, so if they got tick exposed when they were close to breeding, you very possibly get the same result. Okay, we're into an expanded this vaccine trials are being run by the California Cattlemen's Association. You can jot my email address down here. You can contact the California Cattlemen's Association in Sacramento. It's a program that's been set up to expand the trials. Data has to be acquired. It's USDA approved, but we've initiated into this, and so far I think we're up to we've probably vaccinated around 3,000 or 4,000 heifers so far. Okay, now what I'm going to finish up with quickly here is the recombinant work that that Brian Welly did for his master's degree. And really what the skid mouse was able to do was provide us enough bacteria that we could actually do a genomics analysis and, like I say, conducted in Dr. Van Inenhoven's lab. And really what we did is we contributed to the bacteria and they contributed the genomic science because it is not my forte. So they were able to sequence the genome of this bacteria, which was no small feat, and then took what's referred to as a reverse vaccinology approach, and that is it enables you to select genes that would be vaccine candidates, put those into plasmids, put them into an alternate host, produce the proteins, purify the proteins, and use these proteins for other diagnostics or potential vaccine candidates. So Brian started out with over 2,000 open reading frames. And he wheedled this down. I seem to be missing part of the slide, but that's okay. Down to 10 proteins that were either adhesive, had a high adhesion score, or had, according to the vaccinology program, had a high probability of being good candidate vaccines. Oh, here we go. So adhesion probability of 0.5% of 0.5, and a protective antigenicity score of 0.5. Okay, he came up with these 10 proteins and sent those off and had those commercially produced and purified. And we got those back into the lab and started doing an antigenicity testing. And so what we did is we took serum from either EBA-aborted fetuses, from mice that had been inoculated with the bacteria, or cows that we know had been exposed to the bacteria or intentionally infected. We did something called a Western blot on each one of those candidate proteins with the idea of finding, are any of those 10 proteins that's a host, any of these three infected hosts make antibodies to them? And in fact, most of them appear like they did. We had one protein here, we're calling it protein number 3, that we had absolutely no background with non-infected animals and a perfect response with the mouse and the bovine, the cow that's been infected, as well as the fetus. So Western blot conclusions, the reverse vaccinology approach worked. It helped predict the antigenic vaccine. It helps predict vaccine candidates, and 7 of 10 of the proteins displayed signs of antigenicity. Protein 3 showed 100% specificity, and specificity it probably has great potential for a diagnostic to be used in ELISA or something of that nature. And with that, I thank you for your attention.